This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
What's up, preacher man?
FBI Director James Comey testifying before the Senate yesterday about what happened with Hillary Clinton in the election. What was revealed? We'll talk about that on The Patriot Preacher. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to The Patriot Preacher, covering the news from a Christian perspective. Good morning to all. Welcome to the program. I am Caleb Colquitt, your humble host, as always. And with everything that was going on in Washington the other day, it was a big news story because James Comey, I think, is, interestingly enough, one of the most divisive figures in Washington for being very dedicated to doing his job properly. And that's the reason that he's controversial. I mean, we've seen this guy be both the hero, the savior of both parties, and then the next week he switches and he's the worst villain in Washington for that party and the hero of the other party. Which, to me, the fact that he keeps switching back and forth between being the hero or the villain of each party means he's probably actually doing his job. So I have a lot of respect for James Comey. I'm saying that right out of the gate, and yesterday confirmed an awful lot of that. James Comey testified before Congress yesterday, testified before the Senate. He's supposed to testify before the House today about this issue that came up with him revealing that Hillary Clinton's investigation had been reopened 11 days before the election. Now, there's ample reason why members of the Congress on both sides would be interested in his decision-making process in this, and I don't blame them for that. However, it is important to unpack this and break it down. He said that he was actually mildly nauseous, and by the way, just for my professors at Auburn, in case they happen to be listening, I have to mention that he's using nauseous incorrectly there. This comes from a litany of journalism classes. He means nauseated, not nauseous. Nauseous means you make other people sick. But anyway, I don't know. Maybe it seems like lately he has been making the Democrats sick, so maybe that was correct. I don't know. But I think he meant nauseated there. Anyway, he said that he was mildly nauseous over the idea that he swayed the election in one direction or the other. Now, did he actually affect the outcome? He did in the term of numbers. Now, personally, looking at electoral maps, looking at polls and being watching them like a hawk, especially that last month of the election, I think that James Comey's coming out and announcing that she was under investigation again did affect the polls. I don't know that it affected them enough to change the outcome of the election. You would have to do state by state to really change that, because the kicker for Donald Trump, he actually, if you're looking at the Electoral College, he won pretty handedly. It really wasn't all that close. Not to say that it certainly was not as close as several previous elections have been. I mean, it wasn't near Obama's numbers, but it was, if you're looking at it, it was not as close as, for instance, the Gore Bush election. So when you're looking at this objectively, you would have to say no honest person could look at the polls that last few weeks and say that James Comey's coming out and saying that she was under investigation did not have an effect on the polls. But there's a difference in having an effect and having an effect big enough to change the outcome, which I don't know that could be proven one way or the other. Now, just to explain exactly what's going on here, what we're talking about, you have to put yourself kind of in James Comey's shoes here for a second. There is a person under investigation because she is a former Secretary of State, and it was learned that she had a secret server that she was keeping government documents, government property, in her house without authorization that nobody knew about, or at least nobody knew about and reported it. And so she has essentially what is government property that is supposed to be available to them at all times hidden away in her own private email server. And after that investigation goes on, now everybody had a pretty good inkling that the FBI was investigating her, and then it turns out that it was confirmed that it was true. And then when they concluded their investigation, they presented their findings. James Comey was the front man on this. He went to present his findings and say, but we're not recommending charges. See, at that moment, he was Hillary Clinton's best friend. And I'm using that in the metaphorical sense, not that they were actually buddies, just that when that happened, he was her hero because he did not recommend charges. And the Democrats were talking about how great and fair and honest James Comey is when that happened. So he did this, and we have documentation. I covered this a couple weeks ago. We have new documentation from the New York Times that they reported, not exactly a conservative-leaning newspaper there, that when James Comey did all this, they have the actual transcript, some of the emails and the correspondence that were going back and forth between James Comey and his subordinates and other people within the Justice Department about how to handle this. It seems as though he wanted to finish that investigation as quickly as possible so it would be as far away from the election as possible, so it would not affect the election. Their findings, one way or the other, wouldn't affect the election, or at least any more than, you know, had to be done. So what he did was he finished it before the primary was even over, before she had secured her party's nomination. Now, granted, she had it pretty much wrapped up at that point, but it wasn't official. And so they went ahead, finished it, finished the investigation, presented it to America with their findings, and left it all on the table and walked away, feeling pretty good about what they had done and staying out of the election. Well, I still think that they should have recommended charges, but that's neither here nor there. I'm just giving you the facts about what happened. Now, you fast forward until 11 days before the election. Well, actually, a little bit further away from it than that. This is about 12 or 13 days beforehand. They learn through a completely separate investigation into Huma Abedin's husband, Anthony Weiner, who happens to also be Hillary Clinton's campaign advisor and close personal friend, that it turns out there are some copies on Anthony Weiner's laptop, because he shared it with his wife, of some of these emails that are still government property that they did not have. And they're from that period that Hillary Clinton deleted an awful bunch of those emails. So what did we learn out of this? Well, we essentially confirmed what everybody suspected and pretty much knew ahead of time, which is there were several emails that somehow got deleted, and by somehow I mean Hillary Clinton deleted them on purpose, were in that period that she did not turn in to the federal government. But there was nothing in them that suggested that it was classified information, so there was really no new information. James Comey had already promised Congress that if anything new came up about this, because he did have to testify before Congress with his findings, that if anything new developed with this situation, that he would inform them. And so, in part to keep his word, and in part because he would have done that regardless of who was running for president, he had to come out and or be accused of trying to help Hillary Clinton by keeping it quiet. He had to come out and tell Congress, yeah, we found some new information, we're reopening the investigation. But when he did that, he did his very best to get done with it before the election, and wound up doing it about, I think, 8 days before the election, announced that the new investigation, they went through it, it doesn't appear that there's anything new in there, no new information, and so we're sticking with our original verdict, as it were. And so you had all that going down. James Comey was doing his best to stay out of the political realm. He can't help when evidence falls into his lap and he has to reopen an investigation. And so that's the story that we've got right now. Democrats are now asking, and their big question is, well, that's fine, but why not talk about Trump's investigation at that time? We'll answer that question when we come back. Stowing away the
time. Are you gathering up the tea? This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
The doctrines of Jesus are simple and tend all to the happiness of man. Thomas Jefferson.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to The Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers, and we do have someone on the phones who we're going to go to in just a second. Wanted to make this point real quickly first. Before we get to him, and you can call in too, 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to. I'm about to take some callers, so if you want to get in, now would be the time to call. So what we're talking about right beforehand is everything that happened with James Comey and why he decided to speak out about Hillary Clinton just 11 days before the election. And now Democrats are asking the question, well, that's, you know, you were in a tough position, and they'll admit that. But if that's the case, why not also comment about Donald Trump and his ongoing investigation into the probes with whether or not his campaign was synced up with Russia and they were having communications with Russia? Well, here's the thing. These are two wildly different scenarios. I mean, yes, they were both running for president, but that cannot be taken into consideration when making decisions on investigations. Because if you're considering that, then you're making decisions based on politics. And so when you're stuck in this situation where he had a couple of investigations on his desk, each of which pertaining to a presidential candidate at this point, you have to keep in mind, A, there's absolutely no precedent for this. I'm fairly certain, and I am a student of history, and I know I don't know everything, and I may be missing something here, but I'm pretty sure there has never been a presidential election where even one of the candidates was under investigation, much less both of them. So we're living in a time where this was completely unprecedented for both candidates. And so there's no protocol really to follow on something like that. But secondly, he was stuck in a position either way. He was going to be ridiculed by one side or the other, regardless of the election's outcome, regardless of whether he spoke out or not. Because here's the thing. Had he sat on that information with the election going on and had not spoken out, then he would have been accused of trying to help Hillary Clinton win the White House. And what if she had won because of that? Because their argument is that swayed the election. Well, let's just say for the sake of argument that that's exactly right. The Democrats, we accept their premise. They're correct. That is what caused Hillary Clinton to lose the election. Well, if he had come out and or if he had sat on that information and said nothing, and Hillary Clinton does get elected, and then the Republicans find out afterward that he sat on that information, broke his word, didn't tell them when new information had come to light, even though he promised the American people that he would, if anything new developed on it, 11 days before the election because he was afraid that it would sway the election. Well, then all of a sudden, James Comey's in Hillary Clinton's back pocket. He's actively helping her win, and he arguably... Now, granted, this is a what-if scenario, and we'll never know for sure because we don't live in an infinite dimension universe or whatever. We can't see how this would have turned out otherwise. But the point is, had that happened and James Comey were responsible for Hillary Clinton being in the White House, he would have been accused, and rightfully so, of sitting on the information because she was running for president and not treating her impartially as if she were any other person, any other citizen of the United States that was under investigation. And so he was stuck in a no-win situation in that particular scenario. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Mr. Conservative on line one. It's been a while, Mr. Conservative. Good to hear from you.
Yeah, listen, welcome to the airwaves.
Thank you.
I love the show. Appreciate what you're saying and your perspective. I agree with what you're saying about Comey. I think he is a straight arrow, and we conservatives get down so often on government employees, and they're lazy, they're overpaid, they're just bureaucrats. But we've got to have people like James Comey who just does his job, who feels that his job is important, and it feels like his integrity is important. And I do have a lot of admiration for him. Now, I do depart in his own, from his judgment on one thing.
Okay.
That is his conclusion that, well, there was no evidence that Hillary Clinton intended the nation any harm, you know, from this.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't intentionally malicious. Maybe it was lazy, careless, negligent, I think was the word that he used. I do have a problem with that because, you know, Congress can put intent into statutes, like, you know, First-degree murder requires proof of intent. You plan to kill the person, not accidentally. But in that statute, there was no intent. It was...
Right, intent is not a qualification to be a crime in that particular situation.
Right, and so I, that's where I, I'm not saying his judgment was swayed by politics. It's just, I just have a problem because I think a lot of people, a lot of military people, a lot of Pentagon people have gotten in trouble for doing, far less than what she did.
Yes, and I actually have friends that are government employees that work for the Fed that every single one that I've talked to said, if I did anything anywhere near that, I would be fired and probably be in prison.
Yeah, and I'm not saying, it may have been just, charging her with a misdemeanor count if that was possible, but
a lesser charge.
Let her off scot-free, I think, is a problem.
No, I actually agree with you 100%, Mr. Conservative, and the thing is with that, I disagreed with the conclusion of that investigation as well, but the way that he brought that out, and I was upset about it when I found out she was not having charges recommended too, but what we found out from that New York Times report, and I'm not trying to make excuses for Comey, I'm just saying that this is the facts as I believe that he sees them, is that even if he had recommended charges, they would not have been brought forward because he thoroughly believed, based on his private correspondence that we had back and forth between him and his subordinates, that Loretta Lynch was actively in the bag for Hillary Clinton and trying to help her get elected. And so I think he felt like his hands were tied at that point. I'm not saying that he did the right thing by not recommending charges. I'm just saying that that might have been part of his motivation for not going forward, because he even said in that testimony, famously, that if this were anybody other than Hillary Clinton, this would not be happening, which is incredibly problematic for me as a law-abiding citizen, that if I did exactly what he did, the director of the FBI is essentially saying to me, do not think that you would get this treatment from us. This is only something we're doing for Hillary Clinton, and that is bothersome to me.
It is me, too. One of our founding concepts is we are a nation of laws, not of men.
Amen.
And when we let somebody off because of who they are, I mean, that just goes against them. I'm going to run, but great show, Caleb. You have a good day.
Thank you so much, Mr. C. And he's exactly right. And that was something that was bothersome for me, too. Trying not to get off subject here, just looking back at it. That was the problem that I did have with the way that Comey did not recommend charges. I think that he made this decision correctly, but at the same time with the charges, that's something I'm going to have to break with. We have to all be equal under the law. That's what the idea of blind justice is. All right, we'll be right back with more on this.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
John 13:34-35. A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another, even as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this all men will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another.
Welcome back. You are listening to the Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. Call in 860-1440 if you want to weigh in. Keep in mind that we do have a giveaway for a 2-pack of Biscuits tickets to see them play the Chattanooga Lookouts on the 12th. You can call in and win those today. We've already had Tim and Curtis win a 2-pack of tickets. So if you want to be a winner as well, you can call in, go on the air just like they did, and be a winner yourself. Now, I did want to mention this before we get back into our discussion about James Comey and Hillary Clinton in the election. Talladega is this weekend. So don't miss Dale Jr. in one of his final races at Talladega Super Speedway. Call 877-GO-TO-DEGA or visit Talladega Super Speedway now to get your tickets. So you can check it out on their website or call 877-GO-TO-DEGA. Be sure to check that out. Big event, big tourist attraction for the state of Alabama. You know, NASCAR is actually one of the very few sports that still labeled a growth sport. So it's one of the only sports that it's actually increasing in fans. It's not staying stagnant. So big deal for our state. Be sure to check that out if you're interested in going to Talladega.
It has been for a long, long, long time. Whenever you look at, whenever you do the research, the biggest attractions, well, you you just know that. I mean, over 100,000 people, they aren't all from Alabama.
Oh, no, certainly not. We get people from all over the country coming to Talladega. It's a big attraction, big deal for our state. So be sure to check that out this weekend. All right. Now, with everything that was going on with James Coleman, we were just talking about this. We talked about he was in a no-win situation when it came to choosing whether or not to discuss Hillary Clinton right before. And so what a lot of Democrats have done, they have made the case, which on the surface does make sense. Well, that's fine, but if he was going to talk about Hillary Clinton's investigation, he should have also said, oh yeah, by the way, Donald Trump is also under investigation. His campaign is being investigated. Well, actually, Donald Trump wasn't under investigation. Donald Trump's campaign was under investigation. There is a fine but important difference. Is he running the campaign? Yes, he's the top guy. But is he under investigation for personally doing anything wrong? No. So there is a slight difference there. Now, actually, this is the important point to bring up in all of this. Had he commented on the Trump investigation, that would prove that politics were a consideration in his decision-making process. Because here's the thing. If he has to make a decision as to whether or not to comment on the campaign or comment on the investigation because, well, I have to comment on that one too, because that would be fair because Donald Trump's under investigation. That means that would ensure actually that he were injecting himself into politics because he's making a decision based on who is running for president. See, you have to ask the question, what would I do if nobody were running for president, if neither one of these people were running for president or had ever held a political office? And that's actually the problem that I talked about with Mr. Conservative recently, just right before the break, about that. I believe that he would have recommended charges if it were anybody but a former First Lady and Secretary of State. And that's the problem that I had with that decision. But in this particular scenario, had he done that, had he come out and said, well, in the case of, we're going to comment about the Hillary Clinton thing, but to be politically fair, we've got to come out and tell people that Donald Trump's also under investigation. See, that would have been using politics to justify making a decision on an investigation, and that would have been wrong. Had neither one of them been running for president, and it just happened to be 11 days before the election that he got this new evidence, he would have gone to Congress and informed them anyway. See, to me, the decision that he made actually was the apolitical decision to make, the one that kept politics out of the decision-making process. Had he commented on Donald Trump's investigation just because that happened to be the guy running against Hillary Clinton, then that would have been him using politics as an excuse to make a decision based on making a decision based on politics in an investigation, which would have been unfair. So the Democrats are suggesting that he, when they say that he should have mentioned Donald Trump, what they are suggesting actually is he should have made a political decision. They're upset with him that he didn't, if you're thinking this through. Also, remember that Comey, and we know this from the correspondence that he had with his subordinates that we took from that New York Times report that came out, I guess it was early last week, maybe late the week before that. But anyway, we have that new report that gives us some insight into his thought process and gives us a timeline for that. Remember that James Comey, as well as everybody else in the know, myself included, thought that Hillary Clinton was going to win, regardless of this. I thought she was going to win. And predicted it, of course, I wound up being wrong. But everybody that was following the polls, that was looking at this, they believed that Hillary Clinton had this pretty much wrapped up. Now, I said that it's going to be closer than people thought it was going to be, but I still thought she was going to win, and so did James Comey. So here's the thing. People are accusing James Comey of doing what best interested him, that this was in his self-interest, and that's the way that he did it. But here's the problem with that theory. If Comey believed, and we know from his correspondence now that he did, that Hillary Clinton was going to be the president of the United States anyway, the thing to sustain himself, the smartest thing for James Comey to do for James Comey, is to keep his mouth shut. The smartest thing for James Comey to do would be to do absolutely nothing, sit on that information, not mention that Hillary's under investigation, and then he keeps his job when Hillary Clinton's president. Because keep in mind, James Comey was her hero up until 11 days before the election because he came forth and recommended that no charges be brought against her. So she loved James Comey up until that point where he announced that the investigation was reopened, if he wants to keep his government job, all he has to do is keep his mouth shut and just ride it out. But that's not what he did. What he did was put his own job at risk. He thought that he was basically ending his career by bringing that up 11 days before the election, because he thought that his new boss was going to be the person that he announced is under has had their investigation reopened 11 days before the election. See, he did this at his own personal expense. He wasn't doing this for gamesmanship. He didn't expect her to win. Nobody, or he didn't expect Donald Trump to win. I didn't expect Donald Trump to win. Very few people did. And right, good point, Joe. I don't know that Donald Trump expected to win in that particular situation. So you could kind of see the writing on the wall. He was already preparing for a loss. So, you know, looking at all that information, frankly, if James Comey was doing just what was right for him, well, the best thing to do for him was to keep his mouth shut. So, you know, in my opinion, James Comey acted admirably, at least in that sense. All right, so we're going to take a break here a little bit early, but before we do, I want to mention our good friends at Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center. Now, these are great people, experienced, professional, know exactly what they're doing. They know cars inside and out. You bring your automobile to them, they're going to look at it, and they're going to tell you exactly what it needs done. They'll be able to find the problem quickly, and they're going to be able to fix it and have you back on the road in and out as quick as possible. I've been in there when it's in the middle of the day. It's absolutely swamped. I've had literally 12, 13 people in line ahead of me. They're still able to get me out in just a couple hours, even if it's something big like putting new tires on my truck. So these guys work quickly, they give you a good price, and they're going to be honest with you about what's going on with your car. That's how they've stayed in business for 50 years right here in the capital city. Check them out today on the Troy Highway. That's Jim Woodham, Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center. We'll be back.
I wonder where I'd go if I could fly around downtown.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
The Declaration of Independence laid the cornerstone of human government upon the first precepts of Christianity. John Quincy Adams.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to The Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. Call in 860-1440 if you want to weigh in. Before we move on, did want to mention, what would make your mom feel like the number one greatest mom? Of course, you know Mother's Day is coming up. Maybe a trip to the spa, cleaning services for a year, an epic shopping spree, maybe 1,000 bouquets of roses. In celebration of Mother's Day, we're giving you the chance to win $4,000 for Mom by telling us what makes her great and what you would do for her if you won. So enter today at newsradio1440.com. Now, getting back to what we were talking about with James Comey and Hillary Clinton, it's funny because Hillary Clinton did this interview just the other day explaining why she won explaining why she lost the 2016 election. Again, I'm still operating on that alternate universe theory that Joe and I were talking about in the break. But anyway, so with Hillary Clinton losing the 2016 election, she's basically blaming everybody but herself. Now, she said, and I think Rush brought this up in his update, I take personal responsibility, but I lost because everybody else just doesn't like me. She blamed the Russians, she blamed John Podesta, she blamed James Comey. So she's going through all these things. So I'm going to help the Democrats out here, which is something I never do because, you know, I'm a conservative. I generally don't support their policies. I'm going to be a super nice guy here and help the Democrats out. Here's some simple steps that the Democrats can take in the future to win elections, presidential elections against Donald Trump or any other Republican. Now, these aren't guaranteed, you know, shoehorn in, you're going to win for sure. These are just some tips, some learning experiences to take away from this last election of things not to do. First of all, don't nominate a person that has rock-bottom likability. Now, this is a lesson that could go just as easily for the GOP, because the only person to run for president in the history of our country, since they've been, you know, recording likability ratings and polling, the only person with a lower likability than Hillary Clinton was Donald Trump. And so this wouldn't have been... I genuinely believe if we have a Ted Cruz versus Hillary Clinton, Ted Cruz curb stomps her, And if it had been a Marco Rubio versus somebody like Marco Rubio versus Hillary Clinton, it would have been a Reagan-esque landslide. So when we're looking at this, Hillary Clinton was a horrible candidate, easy to beat, and part of that is because she had a rock-bottom likability rating. Okay, another one. Don't nominate a person under FBI investigation. Now, you can crow and whine about James Comey and what came out 11 days before the election if you really want to and blame him for losing the election. But you know the easy way to avoid that? Don't nominate someone under FBI investigation. You guys knew when you elected her, because ultimately it is the voters that put Hillary Clinton. I mean, yeah, I know the superdelegates and it was very much skewed in her direction. I understand that. But at the same time, just like at the end of the day, it was Republican voters that put Donald Trump as our nominee. At the same time, when you're looking at the Democratic Party, when it all is said and done, they're the ones responsible for putting Hillary Clinton as their nominee to the White House. So don't nominate someone under FBI investigation if you don't want something like that to happen to your candidate. All right, furthermore, don't have your attorney general protecting your candidate. This goes back to what we were just talking about. Part of the reason that James Comey took a lone wolf, and we know this from the New York Times report that I just talked about, part of the reason we know that he adopted that lone wolf strategy is because he believed, like a lot of Americans believed, that Loretta Lynch was in the bag for Hillary Clinton. And when she's having secret meetings with her husband 3 days before she's recommending no charges be brought before her, it's kind of hard to argue with that. So maybe don't have an attorney general that's super chummy with a person under FBI investigation who also happens to be your nominee for president. That's another learning experience for you. And finally, don't let your nominee's top advisor be someone married to a pedophile, because that's the reason that this came out when it did, is because Anthony Weiner was sending pictures of his junk to underage girls. And when the FBI investigated it, he also is the husband of Hillary Clinton's top advisor. That ought to be a massive red flag right there, that this is not the person we want as our nominee to our party to be the president. So you can forego a lot of these problems just by nominating people that don't have these hangups. And so you can complain about that all you want to, but it was Hillary Clinton. You knew exactly what you were getting when you nominated her. She was not an unknown. You can't make the argument that, well, we didn't have any idea this was going to happen. It's Hillary Clinton. She has a track record of these things. She's a known quantity. You really have no one to blame but yourself. I'm sorry, but that's the way that it is. Okay, so another thing that she did was she blamed sexism. Not like there's any other possible reason, maybe the four that I just listed, to not vote for Hillary Clinton other than you're just a sexist pig. Well, first of all, there was an awful lot of women that voted for Donald Trump, so I don't know how you explain that one. I didn't vote for Donald Trump. Like I said, don't particularly like the man. And if I had to do it over again, I still wouldn't have voted for him. But at the same time, you can't just blame sexism for people not wanting to vote for you, because this is the same crap that they tried to pull in the last election. If you didn't vote for Obama, it must have been because you secretly hate black people. Well, there are plenty of black people that a lot of those Republican voters would have voted for. If you're looking at the GOP ticket, for example, let's look at that. We had two Hispanics, an Indian, a woman, and a black guy, all in the GOP field. We had a woman and four white dudes in the Democrat field this time. Now, does that mean the Democrats are racist? No, I don't believe that that means that at all. I don't believe it means that I don't assume that in them. But the point is, the same courtesy is not extended to Republican voters. And so this just shows how insanely out of touch they are with the average person. And speaking of that, Bill Maher is doing an interview with Jake Tapper just the other day, talking about this and talking about her blaming sexism. And granted, Bill Maher did start making some sense in this interview. I wouldn't say that the whole thing was a wash. And I would say even that my coverage of Bill Maher is far more positive than most conservatives, because I think that he's on the ball on some things, and I usually talk about that. But I think he's a little off the wall on this one, so we'll go ahead and listen to that. Clip one, Bill Maher and Jake Tapper.
When Hillary Clinton was asked at the event if misogyny played a role in her loss, she said, yes. Do you agree?
Of course, absolutely. I think we learned a lot about this country. and we're learning more about it as we watch what goes on with Fox News every day.
That is a pretty remarkable turn of events. But you think that that's about a misogynistic problem in American corporate culture and not just a few bad apples, I'm guessing.
Not just corporate culture. You know, I think race is more on the surface and people talk about it and there's movements like Black Lives Matter, and I'm glad there are. But I think we thought we were further along on the woman issue than we are, and I don't think we are. I
mean, all right, hang on, right there. Let's pause it. Okay, so what Bill Maher is saying is that a sizable portion of this country cost her the election because she's sexist. Now, this is what I find funny about this is that, and I mentioned it just a second ago, liberals always tend to give themselves a pass when it comes to this stuff. That it's not possible that they can be sexist, but when it's other people, they've got to be sexist. Now, like I said, in the GOP ticket, there were four minority candidates running and a woman running. And I imagine that if any one of those had won the nomination, and some of them were pretty close, let's keep in mind Ted Cruz came within an eyelash of winning this thing, and he's half Cuban. So, and keep in mind his vice president was also Carly Fiorina, and this was the candidate that I was backing. So, had Ted Cruz won in an alternate dimension, since we've been talking about that a lot today, I believe that the vast majority of the people that voted for Donald Trump would have voted for Ted Cruz. In fact, I believe that more people would have voted for Ted Cruz. And so to suggest that a large chunk of the country is sexist and that this election proves that, I don't think is genuine. And I think it's just Maher projecting his own feelings on other people, which I don't think is fair. All right, let's pick it up right there.
So I've had a woman leader. Pakistan has had a woman leader,
so?
But not the United States of us. Somehow we lag behind that. And I know a lot of people say, yes, I'd vote for a woman. I just didn't want to vote for that one. Well, let's see next time when there's another woman put up for president. And I don't know when that's going to happen. It doesn't look like any time soon.
All right. Now pay attention to this.
Well, it might be Elizabeth Warren. We don't know. Well, let me ask you, are there any of the 2020 possibilities, any Democrats that you like, that you hope get into the race?
I still like Bernie Sanders. And I'm constantly, since I turned 60, fighting against ageism. Jerry Brown, you know, is another one who's
okay,
in his
right
70s,
there.
Did a hell of a job turning our state of
California around. Let's stop it right there.
Around.
So here's the thing. Bill Maher is calling half the country sexist because they didn't support a woman in the election. And in the last election, he voted for the old white guy, and when asked who he would like to see run in the future, it's two old white guys. Think about that. Hour two coming up next.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
What's up, preacher man?
GOP's new health care proposal expected to pass the House today. What's in it, and what does it mean for you? We look into that on The Patriot Preacher. I tell you, Joe, maybe we should open with this every single day.
Let me think about it.
Makes me feel like a Jedi.
Well, here's where the theater of the mind comes in. If you can picture this, we have the Patriot Preacher sitting here with his Star Wars Force Awakened black shirt. That's the only thing I forgot to tell you. It's really not Star Wars. No, it is.
It is. Yes. In case you're wondering about all of this, the reason that we're doing this, doing the intro with the Star Wars, the reason I've got my Star Wars attire on today is because today is May the 4th, Star Wars Day, of course. May the 4th be with you. So we're just having a little fun with that. It is Star Wars Day. It's something that's important to me because for those of you who haven't caught on yet, I'm a huge nerd. So that's the reasoning behind that. But
everybody loves Star Wars.
Oh, absolutely. Well, all regular people. So so happy Star Wars Day to everybody. Did want to mention that real quickly as we're getting into the second hour of our show, just because it's something that makes me smile. I hope it does with all of you as well.
Are we going to play some Mexican music tomorrow?
I don't know. I reckon we could. I've got I know I've got La Bamba on there somewhere in that computer. So yeah, okay. You can play that if you want to. But
Herb Alpert.
Or Santana, maybe. I don't know.
Do you remember Herb Alpert?
No, I don't, unfortunately.
Well, I'll tell you someday.
All right. But anyway, yeah. So happy Star Wars Day to everybody. We do have some serious things to get to this hour with everything that's going on in Washington with the health care proposal. Now, with everything that's going on with health care and this back and forth, it appeared as though they were going to be a few votes shy, but the recent reports are saying that that it's improved, that the Republicans are feeling more confident about what's in this bill. Let me explain to you exactly what the issue with that is. A lot of the Republicans that were intending to vote against this bill, the reason that they say that they're more comfortable voting for it now is because they feel better about pre-existing conditions being covered. And what's happened is the $8 billion that has been tacked on to this bill really late in the game, as soon as, I think it's as recently as last night or maybe the night before. But the reason that that's been tacked on is to make the Republicans voting for it, the moderate Republicans, feel more confident that people that have pre-existing conditions that are protected by Obamacare are not going to lose coverage or have to pay more with that. Now, whether or not that's true or not really is irrelevant to me, and here's why. It's not that I don't care about people with pre-existing conditions. It's not that I don't care about people being sick, but I have to look at the bigger picture. And that's what I think most people are completely losing sight of, because the Democrats have decided to make the pre-existing conditions thing their major sticking point. From a political standpoint, that makes sense, because it's popular. People like the pre-existing conditions that can't be discriminated against. So if you're looking at it from a strictly political PR standpoint, the smartest thing the Democrats can do is make that their big issue. And so they're being very politically savvy in doing that. But here's the problem with it. Yes, the inability to discriminate against people with pre-existing conditions is popular, but it's popular for a bad reason. And here's what I mean by that. Americans, and this is what was being talked about on CNN as I was coming in this morning, they were saying, well, the reason that the pre-existing conditions is such a big deal is because people understand it. Actually, they don't. They understand what a pre-existing condition is. They can define it. But that's different than understanding how it affects healthcare in America. You see, the reason that this is such a big sticking point is because people don't understand the effect that having that rule that you can't discriminate against pre-existing conditions has on the rest of the healthcare industry and the people that are within the healthcare industry. And so they want to have their cake and eat it too. Pre-existing conditions and that provision is what's causing our healthcare premiums to skyrocket. It's what's causing these massive increases that are unprecedented, the biggest increases in American history in healthcare, in health insurance. The massive spike that happened because of Obamacare is not entirely, but largely due to the fact that insurance companies were no longer able to discriminate against pre-existing conditions. That's one of the things that helped keep their cost down. And so what they're wanting is, we want cheap health care insurance, but we also want it to cover everything. That's not how the world works. That's not just health insurance. That's anything. That's any product you buy. You can't say, I want more, but I want it to be cheaper. Look, I'm just going to use an example here. As much as I may like to have a ribeye steak at Longhorn, I cannot say to the people at Longhorn, I want you to bring me a ribeye steak and I want to pay $6, which is your cheapest, which is your cheaper appetizer. Well, I'm not getting the appetizer. I'm getting the steak, and it costs them more to make the steak. So they'd be losing money if they did that. So if I come into the restaurant and say, okay, absolutely everything on the menu is now exactly the same price, I want to pay the rock bottom, I can't do that, because then the company's going to go out of business. And so when you want more of a product, you can't pay the same amount that you were paying for the smaller product. And that's just not the way the world works. And health insurance is really no different than any other industry in that sense. And so the current proposal allows states to opt out of that requirement. Doesn't mean that the pre-existing conditions are going to go away completely, which frankly I would be perfectly fine with. getting rid of that requirement. But what it's saying now is that the states are allowed to opt out of that if they want to. And here's my point on that. It is not the federal government's job to police insurance, nor is it the federal government's job to provide or guarantee health care. And that's where we're getting lost in all of this. We're so busy arguing what we want, we didn't stop to ask ourselves, what should we do? What is the government's role here? See, that's one of the problems that we've had really for the past 100 years, since the beginning of the progressive era, is that we never stop and ask ourselves, what is the government's role here? Should the government be doing this? Should the government be providing this, this, and this? We're not asking that question. We're just saying, how does it benefit me? You see, there was a transition in this country right around the dawn of the 20th century, where back before that, people always ask, when they were electing officials, how are you going to keep the government off my back? When the start of the 20th century happened, we saw this transition into, what are you going to have the government do for me? And that transition, though it's taken a very long time to undo a lot of the structures in our country, and healthcare is just one big example of that, that now what we're doing is we're electing officials and electing people based on, how do I personally benefit from it? And so you can't have personal benefits without paying for them. And that's what we're getting lost in. You can't pay less for taxes and want a bigger government. You can't pay less for health insurance and want more coverage. That's not how that works. And so we're struggling with this problem, and we're missing the bigger picture. We're missing we're missing what really makes the problem a problem. And so we're seeing these skyrocketing premiums over the past few years and asking, well, why'd that happen? Well, it's pretty obvious. We made every insurance company charge exactly the same amount for every product, regardless of how much that person uses the insurance. So that's what's really causing this issue. All right, more on this in just a second. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to call in.
Well, we'll float on, good news is on the way. This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Matthew 22:37-40. And he said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the great and foremost commandment. The second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend the whole law and the prophets."
Welcome back. You're listening to the Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to call in. Now, today is a national day of prayer. So we had a little fun with the Star Wars thing at the beginning, just kind of goofing off. But on a far more serious note, today is a designated national day of prayer. And I'm fighting going into a history lesson about all of that right now. But just suffice it to say that today is, there's a good reason for it. And that's the reason that today is a national day of prayer. And so in keeping with that, I'm going to do something a little unusual on the air, not because I have refrained from doing it for any personal reasons, just because usually I find it a little odd, but I think it's appropriate today that I lead everybody in a prayer on the program here today. Now, for those of you who may be driving, and I know that that's probably quite a bit of you if you're listening to me, keep your eyes on the road. I mean, I have a lot of faith, but I think God also wants me to use my brain, so just keep your eyes open and just follow along here. If everybody would that's in a position to bow with me right now. Great Lord, our Father, we appreciate so much the many blessings that you've given to us. We appreciate this great country that you have blessed us with, that gives us freedom to follow you, free of persecution or interference from the government or those that would wish to suppress us and suppress your word. We pray that you would always look after these protections, and that you would continue to help us to see how significant that is, to remember how lucky we are to have that, and instill in us a sense of gratitude for the liberties and the blessings that come with them. Father, we thank you for those of our elected officials. They are not perfect men. They're not infallible. But we appreciate that we have the establishment of government to protect these liberties. We appreciate that you have blessed us with relative peace and a form of government that is done and elected by us, and we pray that we would have wisdom and judgment in the future in electing these officials. We appreciate so much that you rule in the hearts of men, and that your kingdom is not of this world, that we are citizens of your kingdom first and foremost, and we pray that we would live lives worthy of our calling, in a sense that we would always act as citizens of your kingdom first, in our countries and our local towns and other affiliations secondarily, that we would look to you for guidance and strength, and that we would seek each and every day to meditate upon your laws and seek the highest fulfillment of that, which is to become as much like your Son, Jesus Christ, as we can. We thank you for his sacrifices. We thank you for the life that he led to show us the way, and pray that in every aspect of our life, we would always look to you for our encouragement and our guidance in the direction that we need to go. We pray all these things in the name of your beloved Son, Jesus. Amen. All right. So I think that it is important that we take a time to pray and reflect on the things that God has done for us, that we are constantly reminded that that avenue of prayer is there for God's benefit in a sense, but also for ourselves as well. I just wanted to bring that up since today is a National Day of Prayer before we got back into our topic at hand. So that being said, I may mention that more during the Star Spangled Sermon at the end of the show. That being said, I did want to go back to what we were talking about with the healthcare proposal. Now, there's a fairly elegant analogy that I think perfectly explains what the big problem with having the rule that essentially negates pre-existing conditions that can no longer be used as a deciding factor, not only in to provide coverage, but also in the cost of that coverage. So here's the problem with that. Let's say you're in an auto shop. Now, if you're like me, you're in Jim Woodham Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center on the Troy Highway. But if you're, just say you're in any old auto shop, and the government comes down with an edict. Regardless of what is wrong with your car, if you go into an auto shop and seek care for your car, you must pay the same amount for everybody. So if you're getting an oil change, you're paying the same amount as the person that's getting his entire engine repaired. If he has to get a brand new engine, none of it salvageable, you're paying exactly the same as if you go in to get a headlight replaced. I mean, it doesn't matter what it is, how big, how small, you're paying exactly the same price regardless of what it is. Well, what do you think is going to happen to the prices? Well, the cost of engine repair is probably going to go down quite a bit because they can't charge an engine repair for every single little thing they do. But that means that everything else is going to go way up. And so that's one of the reasons that we're seeing this massive increase in the cost of health insurance, because they're no longer able to discriminate based on who is using their product. And so no matter how much or how little you use the insurance, they got to offer essentially the same thing to you as they do to everything, as they do to everybody else. And that's part of the problem that we're running into. You see, when you're talking about healthcare insurance, and you're comparing it to the auto shop analogy, then what's going to happen with that is people that are driving junkers, they're all going to be going there because why not? They're getting a deal. They're going to be paying way less to get their entire car replaced, essentially, than they would for somebody that's getting an oil change. And so doesn't matter to them. They're getting a really good deal. So you're going to have all those people, as soon as they have a problem with their car, no matter how big it is, they're going to be going straight to the auto shop and getting their car repaired. And then you have people with small problems. Well, they have to buy it, because keep in mind, in Obamacare, you have the individual mandate, so you have to have health insurance. Well, they got to buy it anyway, and they're paying through the nose. So why not just go to the auto shop for every little thing? I mean, if you have a screw loose on the side of your car, you can go to the auto shop and have them repair it. And so what you've got is, because they have to pay for it anyway, so they might as well. And so what you've got is you've got two opposing forces, both that are driving the cost up. The first of which is everybody's got to pay essentially the same amount. And so you've got people that are using it, like, God forbid something happens, you have a heart condition or diabetes or cancer, something that's very expensive. You're paying the same as the guy like me who hasn't been to the doctor since he was 8 years old. So, and by the way, that's not an exaggeration. So,
well, you better get checked out. You never know.
Well, maybe if I get health insurance one day, I'll do that.
And of course, when you get my age, you want to like, get checked out once a year.
Right, right. But anyway, so my point is that you're charging the same amount for someone like me that doesn't really cost the insurance company anything. You know, theoretically, if I had health insurance, which I don't. But you also have the people that have massive problems not paying as much. And so what you've got is you're going to necessarily drive up the cost quite a bit when that happens. And the end result is abuse and overuse on one side, which is driving up the prices. And then on the other side, with the people that are getting a deal on it, they're paying less than they're taking out, essentially, that they are being charged less. So they've got to bring the overall cost for everybody up. And so, I want people with pre-existing conditions and problems like that, I want them to be able to have health insurance. I've had sick people in my family that have had that problem before. I understand that. But not at the cost of making everybody else pay through the nose for it. Because what you're doing there is you're robbing everybody else essentially to pay off the one guy. If you have a pool of 40 people and one person has cancer, that's the way insurance works. You've got to pay off that one person that's super expensive, that's taking more out of the system than they're putting in order to keep the other 39 people on their health insurance. And so if you're not charging based on what is used, you're not really insurance. You're just health care. And so that's why they're charging you based upon your risk in order to offset the cost of that one sick person that gets some kind of debilitating disease. And, you know, it's unfortunate that you drew wrong in that particular thing, but that's why you have the other 39 people paying in. That, God forbid, something bad happens to them, they're covered too. But if, you know, all of a sudden all 40 people got sick, then the insurance company wouldn't be able to handle that cost and they would go bankrupt. That's why they have to have the healthy people that aren't really taking out more than they're putting in, that they're covered if something bad does happen. But the expectation is that they're probably not going to. And so if you're no longer able to discriminate based on how much of a product you're using, well, then all of a sudden, those other 39 people, then they're having to pay more for that one person, because you can have 4 or 5 people jump into that pool. And then all of a sudden, the insurance company has to charge more for everybody. And so that's the problem that we're running into with the pre-existing conditions thing. You cannot have cheap health insurance that also isn't allowed to charge people based on what they're using. It can't be done. You can't have your cake and eat it too. I'm sorry, that's just not the way the world works. I wish that it was. I wish we had a world that was free of disease. Or I wish that we had a world that you only paid as you go and you knew ahead of time whether you were going to get cancer or not. But that's not the way the world works. So we have to live in reality here. Just something to think about. We'll be right back. 860-1440 are the numbers. Your calls coming up next.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Galatians 5:1. It was for freedom that Christ set us free. Therefore, keep standing firm and do not be subject again to a yoke of slavery.
Welcome back. You are listening to the Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. Call in 860-1440 if you want to call in, give me your opinion. Keep in mind we do have that 2-pack of Biscuits tickets to see the Biscuits play the Chattanooga Lookouts on May the 12th. So if you're interested in that, call in. We can get you on. Did Don drop here?
Yeah, Don was on, and then he dropped off in small claims.
I got you. Okay, well, we got small on line two. Let's talk to small claims on line two.
Hey, good morning.
Hey, good to hear.
Enjoying your show. I know you're growing as you go, so I've heard some complaints about you, but you're not in the best market, you know. The way I see it is, first of all, your station and everybody around you, they rank so far up the ladder. And then you just keep on doing what you're doing.
Well, thank you, Small Claims. Yeah. You know, everybody's got somebody complaining about them. So, you know, I know there's people complaining about me. So,
but now what you're talking about today, mm-hmm. I've heard you say, and I don't understand where you get this info. So let me just share this with you. Now, you know, when Obamacare came out,
yeah,
I said, oh good. We're going to see the medical industry reformed in America. You know, I said, this is going to lead to it. And actually, what happened was the fleecing of America's people again by the fat cat Republicans that do this every so often, see. And this time, they did it through the pharmaceutical industry, the medical industry, and mainly the insurance industry, see, that fleeced us again into more money. That's what happened. Now, I was thinking that the medical, the Obamacare would give some kind of standard to the whole thing, but my dog just turned on his stuffed animal, if you hear that. But that's what I thought would happen, but it didn't. And now it looks like it's going to have a complete collapse, you know, before there is reform. Now,
probably.
I heard you say a while ago that ain't the way it works, but really, that is the way it works.
Okay, now, well, be specific, because I don't know what you're talking about. Be specific at what I said.
Well, see, right now, there's a whole, there's three forms of medical care in America. Number one, you got the poor people care. St. Marcus Hospital used to be one, you know, the best hospital around for that kind of thing. But now this River Region Center and other people, they provide care that people, that's real cheap, that they can afford. And you know what? It's good care because I go there myself. Now, then you got this middle level of care where these people went from paying $700-$800 a month to $1,500 a month, the middle class. Now, they got a level of care. And then you got actually the top level of care where people that's got a little money say, you know what it takes in America to have real good care? Money.
Yes.
If you got like $20,000 or $30,000 that you can go take your child to San Francisco for a spinal tap and a transfusion and that sort of care to save their life, then you can save their life with money. You can't do that in Montgomery, Alabama.
Well, I mean, we don't have a lot of those specialty things that you're talking about. My own grandmother wound up having to go to San Francisco to get some care for her ovarian cancer. So, yeah, that's true. I don't see what the problem is, though.
But when you say that, no, you can't have pre-existing conditions and cover that and then not pay and not charge people, that's where you're wrong.
Well, economically, you can't. You can't have a Ferrari. You can't give someone a Ferrari and charge them the price for a Hyundai Civic.
Well, now,
it can't be done.
Why are you saying that? Because the world do it.
Well, first of all, they do it, and they have a horrible health care system. You'll wait in line for 6 months. People have actually died in waiting lines under their system.
True.
Yes, it is. England,
they get more
Canada,
care.
And on top of that, we bankroll the entire rest of the world's medical innovation. Because if you're looking comparatively to other countries that have socialized medicine that you're talking about, we put out 5 times more innovation than the next highest competitor being China.
Hey, so that doesn't matter. Look, let me give you
this. Wait, why? So it doesn't matter? So we can just not ever have any more medical innovation anymore because that's what's happening with the rest of the world?
No, what you said, we do 5 times as more.
We do.
But somebody over in England, they don't care about that.
They do if they're getting care that was developed here in America that helps them feel better and helps cure their disease.
Well, I would be willing to say any of those socialized medicine that if you polled, you know, 6 out of 10 say yes, it has helped me and it saved my life.
Well, but now does it help me and does it help me efficiently? Because if you're waiting, this is a story that came out, I want to say, about 2 years ago. There were a report that you had, now granted it was a small chance, but there was like a a 4 or 5 in 1,000 chance that you were going to die in a hospital in the UK out of dehydration. That's how sorry their healthcare insurance is, that if you go into a hospital, they can't even provide basic care. I mean, not even just medical care, basic care.
You mean in the whole of England and Canada now, they don't get, they all die from dehydration?
A lot of them have, yes. There have been several cases where that took place.
Oh, Lord. I mean, you've been reading some good Facebook stuff, but let me give you an example.
Well, it was the BBC, so.
Hey, here's something I know I've seen with my eyes. I just didn't hear it from somebody. And on that end, you know, you said you hadn't been sick, so you're really not a good person to say what you're saying. I've had people, I've handed them checks, okay? And they got out of that chair and prayed to Jesus that they got some money to go to take them to kidney dialysis to keep their life going for some period of time. Just a small amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and you, the service of the poor, especially in the medical industry, has got to be changed. In America,
nobody disputes that, Small. Nobody disputes that we need health care reform.
All right, let me ask you this. Oh, okay. Now, I agree with you there. But see, the medical industry in America is sickening. When you go in there, like 2 years ago, I paid $3 for a pill. And now I pay like $12 for a pill.
Yeah, and do you know what caused that, Small? The government getting involved and hiking up prices.
No, it was a pharmaceutical industry.
Whoa. Hold on, Small. Here's the thing.
Can I finish first?
Well, you've been talking for the vast majority of this segment.
Hey, let me make this statement. It was the pharmaceutical industry paying off the Congress. That's how that happened. It ain't got nothing to do with legislation.
Well, here's the problem with what you're saying, and thank you for your call, Small. I appreciate it. Here's the problem with what you're saying. Free markets and deregulation actually drives down cost. Because what you're suggesting is these evil, greedy pharmaceutical companies just wanted more money and they charge more. Well, if you deregulate the industry, if you allow pharmaceutical companies to compete with one another, which we're not doing now, and you're right, they did pay off Congress. So that's one of the reasons they lobby so hard for their particular congressmen and their elected officials to get in, is so that they will regulate the industry in a favorable way to them, in a way that helps their company, that helps their interest. And that's the reason that they do lobby so hard, and you're right on that. But the problem with it is when you deregulate it, then those big insurance companies can't hire lobbyists. They can't, they can hire lobbyists, but they can't get those lobbyists to enforce their will upon other people. And when you do have that competition between one another, that drives down costs because they can't charge $12 for a pill when their competition is charging $3 for a pill. Nobody will buy their pill. And so they've got to decrease the cost on that. So the problem that you're suggesting is actually accurate, but your solution would do nothing but increase the price even more. That's my point with the whole pre-existing conditions thing. Yeah, that's a problem that healthcare is so expensive. But not allowing people to discriminate based on pre-existing conditions is only making it more expensive. If you don't believe me, before Obamacare passed, the promise was it's going to save people $2,500 on average for a family of four. In that time, in only the past 7 years, and really less than that because it wasn't fully implemented until 2014, our health care insurance premiums for the average family of four have gone up by over $3,000. So at a certain point, you just have to say, scoreboard, look at what's actually happening. That was the result of that policy. Not exclusively, but it was a large contributor to the reason your healthcare insurance skyrocketed. And that's the problem that we're seeing here. I want people that are sick to be able to get care, but not at the expense of every other person. So something to consider. And furthermore, if you do want insurance without risk management, if you want insurance that just blatantly covers everybody regardless of cost, you don't want insurance. You want single payer. And small claims just prove that. So quit saying that you're a free market person, you're free market minded, but you want insurance companies to not be able to discriminate based on that, because if that's what you want a single payer government run healthcare system. That's the bottom line. Star Spangled Sermon coming up next.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Colossians 3:17. Whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks through him to God the Father.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. Call in 860-1440 if you want to weigh in. Now, did want to mention this before we get into the Star Spangled Sermon. Save big on great eats with our latest sweet deal featuring Queen Meats and Wine in Prattville. Grab your $50 value for just $25 beginning at 8 a.m. at newsradio1440.com on Friday. Log in early because this deal is great and going to sell out fast. So be sure to check that out tomorrow at 8 a.m. is when they go on sale at newsradio1440.com. Now, getting into the Star Spangled Sermon, I am actually going to tie it back to something that is important to me and that's going on today. We were goofing off earlier at the beginning of this hour about it being Star Wars Day, which of course it is. But I do think that there's something very human about being drawn to Star Wars and other epics like it. We just like heroics. We like the struggle against good and evil. It's something that appeals to us on a very primal level that we probably can't even really explain. But I think that it has a lot to do with the way God created us, the way God gave us a sense of right and wrong and trying to overcome adversity as people. And so one of the things that I thought about with that is there's a passage in the book of Philippians, Philippians 2, 5 through 8. Have this attitude in yourself, which was also in Christ Jesus, who, although he existed in the form of God, did not regard equality with God to be a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a bondservant, and being made in the likeness of men, being found in the appearance of a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. You see, humans by nature love heroics. We love flashy things. In Star Wars, we like the Jedi Knights that can jump, you know, about three times their height and engage in a sword fight over a boiling lake of lava. I mean, that's just something that appeals to us. It's exciting. It's adventurous. We could do this with any of the Marvel or DC characters. We like heroics. It's something that appeals to us. We like it because it's cool. It's action-packed. But it's interesting to me that what this verse points out is that really that wasn't Jesus. Now, Jesus was a hero. He's the greatest hero to ever live. But he did it in a very unassuming way. Now, why would God choose to reveal himself in such a manner? Because God knows how humans are. He knows how we think. He knows our nature. He could have very well presented Jesus Christ to us, revealed himself, God in the flesh, in such a way that it could have been flashy, that Jesus could have been superhuman, as it were, super strong, you know, durable, although that would have made it much harder for him to die on a cross. He could have had all these extra abilities, but he chose to basically just live like a normal person. He could perform miracles, but he only performed them for the benefit of other people. You know, he wouldn't perform, even when tempted, he didn't perform a miracle for his own benefit. And he, so far as we can tell, we know from the scripture, he felt pain, he felt exhaustion, he felt anxiety. And because of that, God just chooses to reveal himself in this very normal, unassuming, not flashy way. Well, why would he do that? I think there's a few reasons that we can draw from here. First of all, I think it's an example in humility. We can look back at several examples of Christ's life, but the one that I think of really quickly is the way that he washed the disciples' feet. That he said, you call me Lord and Master and are right to do so, and yet I'm here on the ground serving you by washing your feet. And he was doing that as an example to say, if I'm doing this for you, then how much should you, who are just humans, be able to serve your brothers and sisters? And so I think part of the reason he showed up in this normal, unassuming way, the verse that we just looked at, made himself of no reputation in the appearance of a man. So he was doing that to show an example of humility. I also think it was to judge human people righteously. So he can judge a human life in a righteous way because of the fact that he lived it. He's been through the things that we've had. He's had temptations. He's had these experiences as a human. And so that makes him a righteous judge. Now, would he have been righteous either way? Yeah, probably. But since he's come down as earth and lived as a human, he knows what it's like to feel these temptations. He knows what it's like to deal with people on a day-to-day basis. He can say that he is a righteous judge because he's been through all of it himself. And I think that leads us to our next point, which is one of the more profound ones, in my opinion. He did it to experience empathy with us. He showed up as a person, lived his life as this. He wasn't a rich prince. He wasn't a king. I mean, he was a king, but certainly not an earthly one. He didn't have armies or legions to follow his command. And he brings that up when he's on trial with Pilate. So I think a lot of it had to do, the reason he chose to reveal himself in this way is so he could say that he has empathy with us. He knows our struggles. He understands the plight of the common man. He's just this normal working class builder. So he's not exactly somebody from wealth or privilege. I mean, for goodness sake, he was born and immediately put into a feeding trough for animals. That was his bed. And so he's not exactly somebody that couldn't relate to the plight of the average person. He's lived in poverty. He knows what it's like. And so he did this in such a way that he could empathize with our problems. That when we're going through something, we're going through the loss of a friend. We saw him go through that with Lazarus. He probably went through it with Joseph, because in the Gospels, later in it, when Jesus is an adult, Joseph's not in the picture, we can kind of assume that he probably died. He at least wasn't a part of Jesus' life for some reason at that point, so we can assume that he was lost in some way. And so he does empathize with us in the way that we are, in our plight. But more importantly, I think this is the most important reason. I think it was so he could display his love for us in a very real, relatable, intimate, personal way. Because he didn't just love us from afar. He came here to visit us and to love humankind right next to us as one of us. And, you know, we all love Star Wars and the Chronicles of Narnia and Lord of the Rings and all that fantastic stuff, but that's the greatest story ever told. That a loving God created man, and because he loved him so much, he wanted to live amongst us, see what it was like to be one of us, and then give his own life in exchange for us. Stay the course, friends.
The Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.